Unity is strength. We got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more UNITY.
Come. Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now, right now.
Now the time to do the right thing.
Yes, yes, we have to have peace. We have to have peace in Gaza. We have to have peace in St. Louis. We have to have peace, y'all. This is supposed to be a civilized society that we live in on this planet, but we are not acting like we are worthy citizens of the planet. So this is your host, Jamala Rogers, with Voices from the Battlefield. And today is the anniversary of the Dred Scott decision, 1857. So I'm not gonna have you guess who my guest for today is. But before I bring on the great great granddaughter of Dred and Harriet Scott, I want to share a part of the decision. And I wasn't really going to read this part, but I ran into Judge David Mason. And he had asked, and I told him who I was going to have on the program. And he said, well, have you ever read the whole decision? And I had to admit I had not, because the quote that I generally use and use very liberally is about all like a stomach. So he said, you need to read the whole thing. So just as I had imagined, it is hard to stomach, but I want to read a part of it because I want you to get a sense of what Dred Scott was up against in 1857. And remember, this is before Emancipation Proclamation. So here is this audacious black man going to court as a citizen of this United States. And so to me, that is the most inspiring thing about the Dred and Harriet Scott story, and why I always follow it, and you know, I write about it, I talk about it, because I think it has had such an impact, not just on St. Louis and not just on white people, but black people as well. So here is what part of the decision. The question is simply this. Can a Negro whose ancestors were imported into this country and sold as slaves become a member of the political community formed and brought into existence by the U.S. Constitution? And can therefore claim the rights and privileges which that instrument provides for and secure for citizens of the United States? They had for more than a century before regarded as being an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. Now, that is the quote that I always pull out and remind people. The black man has no rights which the white man is bound to respect. I'm going to keep going. And that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery. For if they were so received and entitled to the privileges and immunities of citizens, it would exempt them from the operation of the special laws and from the police regulations which they considered to be necessary for their own safety. It would give to the persons of the Negro race who were recognized as citizens in any one state of the Union the right to every other state of the wherever they pleased, singly or in companies, without pass or passport, and without obstruction, to sojourn there as long as they pleased,
to go where they pleased at every hour of the day or night without molestation, unless they committed some violation of law for which a white man would be punished. And it would give them full liberty of speech in public and in private upon all subjects upon which its citizens might speak, to hold public meetings upon political affairs, and to keep and carry arms wherever they went. That is a part of the 1857 ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court on whether or not a black person had the right to petition for their freedom. I am honored today to bring Lynn Jackson in, who I said before is the great-great-granddaughter of the Scotts, and she is going to talk about the case, the people, the history, and some of what the foundation is doing. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Jamala. Wow, I loved your introduction. Nobody ever read that before.
Yeah, that's some powerful stuff.
Oh, it absolutely is, and especially when you get to the end. And how dare you bear arms?
Yeah, yeah, and go wherever you please.
Say whatever
whenever you please. What do you think you are, a citizen?
Very interesting.
Yeah, that really just dug into my soul, because the other thing that Judge Mason said, he said, now, I want you to remember that because it's a ruling, it can still be cited. Mm-hmm. Somebody could use that court case and cite it. He said it's still on record as a legitimate ruling. I thought, oh my, I never thought about that. So at any given time, you could have, you know, one of these magites or maggots, however you want to say it, decide that they want to do something about black people or brown people and use the Dred Scott case to do that. Now, I don't know how you pronounce the justice's name. Some people say Taney, some people say Taney.
Taney.
Yeah, I say Taney.
W-N.
Yeah. So Taney was the person who wrote this. And so, you know, we have to, I always say, when something is happening in St. Louis is so racist, it's almost unbearable to witness. I said it's the specter of Judge Taney, mm-hmm. because that is in fact a right that white people don't have to respect, and they're acting like it. So yeah, so let's talk about the man, because as I said before in the opening, I am so fascinated and inspired that somebody in 1857. It's so audacious that I want my freedom, and not just my freedom, but the freedom of my wife and my family.
Right. And you know what? I like to help people make this distinction, because now we have the Freedom Suits Memorial, and it shows that we have over 300 people that tried to get their freedom. But the difference is most of those were pretty short-lived cases. Dred Scott's case lasted 11 years. And went through the Missouri Supreme Court to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they didn't buckle under. They continued on. And so that ordeal of 11 years, knowing that whatever happened to their case was going to affect everybody, it was quite a burden to carry, but that's what I love about them.
Wow. That's amazing. And I knew that there were a number of people that had done it, but I think for us, because he was here in St. Louis, that we always need to lift that up and be inspired by him. So talk a little bit about the man, and also how you came to realize that you were even related to him. Is that a discussion that you all had in your family throughout? Remember, you all, were you a part of the Scott heritage, or did you somehow, that came up as part of some unknown piece of history for the family?
No, actually it's been really fascinating, because as I have done my own work and found things out I didn't know, it really unfolds a whole different story for the family. But first of all, you said talk about the man. And so Dred Scott was born around 1799 in Southampton, Virginia. And he was born on the Peter Blow plantation, where Peter and Elizabeth Blow had 11 children. And a few of them died, but many of them survived, and several of them were instrumental in Dred and Harriet getting their case to the Supreme Court. By that I mean that they literally supported their cause. They had spouses They had friends. They had connections because of their positions, whereby they were able to get attorneys and people like that to help them or even do pro bono. So it's real important to know that the Blow family children, who owned no slaves, really got behind Dred. And really, hopefully we'll get to this, but they even supported him after death. So his story is one of being enslaved from birth, but being brought to St. Louis around 1830, at which time both of the parents passed away within 2 years, two years of getting here, and he was sold to a Dr. Emerson, who took him into free territory. We had a law back then that said once free, always free. Dred had been in free territory for a cumulative of several years, as well as Harriet. And so when they ended up in St. Louis, having become the property of Mrs. Emerson, because the doctor passes away, they asked for their freedom. They tried to pay $300 plus bonds for it. No. So they sued her on April the 6th of 1846. They went to the St. Louis Old Courthouse and walked up the steps, filed a petition, was granted a petition, and in 1847, the case fell apart because of bad lawyering.
Even back then, huh?
Yeah, it happens, you know. Hearsay was the problem, but here's an important thing to know, and I want our audience to pick this up. Once the hearsay issue was taken care of, and they actually had the right person on the stand, a jury of 12 white men gave them their freedom right there at the old courthouse on January of 1850. Now, note this also, that Harriet filed her own separate case as well. So it wasn't just Dred, it was Dred Scott, a petition, Dred Scott, and Harriet Scott, a petitioner as well. And so they won, but it was appealed, and that's when we were like off to the races, mm-hmm. I like to say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ultimately, as you read, it ended up in March 6th, today's anniversary date, March 6th, 1857, where they said that blacks had no rights, that whites were bound to respect, and that they were inferior beings, in fact, so far inferior, that they shouldn't even associate with the white race. Justice Taney wrote the majority opinion. I usually say that in quotes because all nine justices wrote an opinion. That's very rare and hardly heard of. But they all had different reasons, and there were two dissenters whose writings are really worth looking up. That was McLean and Justice McLean and Justice Curtis. The dissents are amazing, but 7-2, they lost. And yet they did get their freedom 3 months later at the old courthouse, the same place they started, by the 10th of those 11 children I told you about, Taylor Blow. And he paid for two $1,000 freedom bonds for them to get their freedom license, to be able to walk and be all those things you said they couldn't have, they were able to get. It all hinged on citizenship. The 14th Amendment overturned that portion of the Dred Scott decision. So
I was going to ask you to explain that to people, but you did. Because if, in fact, even if somebody bought it, if the law of the land is you still are not a citizen, you still will never be free, mm-hmm. how was that counteracted? But you talked about the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, let's just make that real clear. From the Dred Scott decision came the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery. And that was in December of 65 because Lincoln had already put that in motion before he was assassinated. And then the 14th Amendment, which was saying that all people born in America or naturalized became citizens. And that was specifically so that the ex-slave could be a citizen. That's what the 14th was for. Of course, there are a lot of attendant issues there. But the 15th also gave the Negro man the right to vote. So those three amendments are often called the Dred Scott Amendments as well, Reconstruction Amendments, but they are a direct result of Dred and Harriet Scott's case.
So I just want to go back to the issue of when and how did you know that these were descendants, because I think sometimes we don't talk about the people in our families, and then somehow by some hook or crook, we find out that we're related to X, Y, and Z, and then everybody gets, you know, animated and rejuvenated about that. Did you always know that you were a descendant?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yes, we did. We did. And I'll circle back to this, something I was telling you about my own research. First of all, my father, Dr. John A. Madison, Jr., and I hope some people in your audience will remember my wonderful dad. He was the family spokesperson, and he was the sixth of seven children of my grandparents. And John Sr., my grandfather, was Dred Scott's grandson. And I like to say it that way so people can do like a real hop, skip, and get mm-hmm. from him to me. Mm-hmm. So Daddy was the family historian among his brothers and sisters. He has a law degree from Lincoln and a degree from right here, Harris Stowe Education. But when I was growing up, you know, we knew, but the little people didn't know how important it was. Okay, we knew, and it was all, that's cool. Okay, some of my cousins were real blasé about it until we started doing more work recently. But what happened was there was a huge gathering at the old courthouse when I was very little, about this tall. And I remember saying, wow, somebody, this is really, really important. And my dad played Dred Scott. Okay. And he sat in the courtroom, and there were, you know, this was a big deal. It was the 100th anniversary. And there were cameras and lights, and Daddy was very vocal, very great orator, but he never spoke. And I'm thinking, what's wrong with Daddy? He's not saying anything. And at that young age, I had no clue that, of course, the slave couldn't speak on his own behalf. So Daddy never had any lines, but he was dressed up to be Dred Scott. So that was one of my first real memories. But also, there was a headstone put at Calvary, and we were there when all of that, and we'll circle back and talk about that later. But here's the thing. Growing up, we would always have events like March 6th or some other event, like someone gave my grandmother Grace Madison a silver plate acknowledging her as the mother of all the Dred Scott descendants. And I still have that picture of the family gathered around for that. And so there were these little hits and misses, but never quite the conversation like you were saying. And I think those in our community understand that, you know what, we want to just like leave that over there for a minute. But I think even more in our family, the fact that some people could say, well, they started the Civil War. You know, it's kind of like, so the last thing I'll share with you about how we knew, and this blew my mind, is that Dred Scott had two daughters, Eliza and Lizzie. Literally, coming down, the story was told that Lizzie married Wilson Madison, and when I did my research, a lady and I worked on our genealogy and found out that it was the wrong sister that we had as our great-grandmother, and it was really Eliza who married Wilson Madison.
Oh, wow.
We discovered that in 2006.
Oh, boy.
That's very recent. However, there's this little caveat here, and I don't know why, because my lovely lovelies are all gone. I can't ask them. So here's my commercial. Y'all talk to your people.
Yeah.
Because I grew up with my grandmother and aunt weekly, going right here to the church in the Ville. They never once told me that Dred Scott's youngest daughter lived to be 99 years old. She died in 1945. And they knew her. And my dad and his younger sister, the last two children, they were babysat by her. They were almost grown when she died. Did they ever mention that? I'm going to get them. I'm shaking my fist. I'm going to get them. But we discovered that. And so we have her death certificate, and we have how she changed her name and everything. So it's a really fascinating story. But because of those things, and maybe she was like a recluse that was part of the oral history, we just, you know, Dred Scott, yeah, but I'm not going to talk about that because that was my daddy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I'm here, and she helped raise my dad and siblings when my grandfather died when they were early and young. So, yeah, it was a fascinating story, but it was really just the idea that he was important, and we knew, and we honored him, but it was never anything like
all nothing public. Like, this is just a family guy.
It's things like local. Mm-hmm, you know, St. Mm-hmm. Louis people knew. You know how it is here in St. Louis.
Yeah,
in the Ville.
Yes, I do.
We all know each other, and we respect that. And there were brilliant people living there, educated people. But, you know, as far as what we're doing now globally, nobody knew.
So I would say, even Lynn, that the knowledge was there in the Ville, but outside of the Ville, that there were still people who did not know who Dred Scott was and the significance of that case, just like I'm still finding out that people don't know Homer G. Phillips. They know it's a hospital, but in terms of the story of the man, they don't know. So you're one of the people that I'm calling defenders of Black history, because somebody's got to be the steward.
somebody's got to say this is important, whether it's a family member or not. Mm-hmm. But in this case, you have even more reason to preserve that history. And you've done that through a foundation. So talk about the foundation, when it was formed, and what's its mission and what it's been doing and what it's destined to do.
Well, little did I know. I mean, seriously, I had no plans to do this, but it was a destiny, I'm sure, that I would start this foundation in 2006 officially, but we started talking about 2003, knowing that the 150th anniversary was coming up in 2007. So at the time, I worked for Brian K. Blaufer, which is Brian K. Layton and Paisner right now, and they were amazingly awesome. They just said, hey, you know what, free reign, leave her alone, let her do whatever she needs to do. And so I was able to form the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation 2006 with the three pillars of commemoration, education, and reconciliation. The first two I understood clearly because I knew we were going to have this program for a year, and St. Louisans rallied behind us. We had 40 organizations here that had something that they did for the 12 months to lead up to 2008. And then we knew there was no statue of Dred anywhere in the world. So I was thinking, well, you know, we'll do this anniversary, we'll blow that out, and we'll get a statue, and then that'll be great. Yeah. But wow. The day after the anniversary, I found myself standing in D.C. at the National Conference of Attorney General. All the attorney generals in the country that could get there were at this conference. And I was one of the key speakers. I thought, well, this is kind of crazy. And a month later, I was at Harvard with Dr. Charles Ogletree Jr. and the Supreme Court and so many notables. And it just seemed like it just took off like a rocket. Mm. But this was God's plan. So that's how we started it, and that's what we stand for. Reconciliation was not something I quite understood. Education was, we all understood.
Yeah, be clear on that.
But what was I supposed to do with that? I didn't know, but I heard that from upstairs, and it's like, okay. And little did I know that I was going to get my dream answer, which was to meet descendants of people involved in this case, such as the Tawnies, such as the Blows, Thomas Jefferson, Jefferson Davis, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, eventually. I mean, so I have a group now called Dred Scott Presents Sons and Daughters of Reconciliation. And we have signature panels, and we meet, and we come, and we go. In fact, I'm going to be in Little Rock for the Brown v. Board of Education's 70th anniversary.
Yeah, that's coming up.
Yeah, coming up in June. So we work together beautifully, wonderfully well, but we'll get back to that. But I do know the Tawney family now, and they are part of my group.
So it's interesting that what kind of people, what are their politics? Are they, were they reluctant to come in until they understood the reconciliation part? Because I would think that initially folks like that might say, oh, I know you're trying to draw me in so y'all can beat up on me based on what my ancestors did. What's been their view and what's been their work around the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation?
This is like the most amazing story on the planet to me. I wanted to find them and sought out to find them probably back in 2008 or 9, and no such luck, okay, but still looking. And in 2016, I had received an email from a young lady, and her name, she said, I am Kate Tawney Billingsley, and I have written a play about descendants of Roger B. and Dred Scott meeting over coffee in today's time. I wonder, is anyone out there from Dred Scott's family I could invite to New York to see my play? And I just couldn't believe it. I've been looking for them for like 12 years, and they found me. So, yes, I went to New York, and I saw this amazing play that at the time a 31-year-old white girl wrote, beautiful young lady. And she put such powerful words in Dred Scott's mouth that nobody could believe that she wrote it. And it was phenomenal. It was only a 20 or 25-minute play, one-act play. But it was there. And we were at the Actors Studio. Estelle Parsons, some people may remember the actress. She's still kicking at 90.
Mm-hmm.
And she's the one that said to her, why don't you reach out and find somebody if you can? And that's how that happened. So when I came to see the play, the first night, I said, you know, they wanted me to do a talk back after the play. And I said, well, you know, I probably won't mind doing that, but I don't want to do it the first night. I want to see the play first. I need to see what sit up there and have to say, oh, that was not good. But as it turns out, there were people in the audience, and the Actors Studio was small, but some of them looked like they could have been part of the Black Panther movement. I mean, there was just a variety of people, but you know, that's New York. And you would think that, boy, if this didn't go well, they were going to hear about it. Everyone raved over it. Mm. And so it was performed here in St. Louis at one point by the Black Rep. Ron Himes helped us with that. But here's the good news. The good news is that she has expanded it and created an hour and a half play now. So in a week, next week, I'm going to New York again to see the new version. Mm-hmm. She's changed the name of it to American Rocked. And it will have the same thing, but it sounds amazing. So let me back up and say this. When they called and contacted me, and I went to New York, I had not met them before. What are their politics? Their politics notwithstanding, their thoughts about their ancestor is such that was messed up. And we don't like it either. And that's why she wrote the play. And this is a real cute story that how her dad, Charlie Tawney, who's really my counterpart in all of this work that we do mostly, Charlie and his many siblings would always discuss this over Thanksgiving dinner. Should we apologize? Yeah, probably. No, I don't know. Do we really need to? Back and forth. And so Kate, growing up hearing this every year, said, hey, guys, you all are just stale. I'm going to do something about it. And that's why she wrote the play. And so the play is going
to
be
give it to the young people. They're going to run with it. Yes.
Yeah, she,
yes.
Oh, and they're so amazing. So anyway, when Charlie and I, as sons and daughters, and we've all been on different panels. Kate's been to St. Louis. He's been here. We've been to Virginia. I mean, we've been to New York. We've been to Maryland. We really do this thing. But Charlie makes it real clear. He explains to the audience, you know, what has to happen for reconciliation. And he shares that. And then he shows, and we share how he did it. On the 160th anniversary of the Dred Scott decision in Annapolis, Maryland, in front of the Tawney statue, 3 weeks before it came down, he offered a public apology before a cadre of media. It was in over 200 papers around the country and in a few other places. But it's not like I needed it or he felt he had to do it. It was like, let's just make this happen because it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And we now have built a relationship between us that we understand each other, and there is a great admiration between us all. I absolutely can't wait to go back and see them again because I love how they have owned their story and shared the truth of the matter.
So that's a wondrous story, and I'm thinking that is definitely a reconciliation between the Scott and Tawney families. Mm-hmm. How does that translate to society? Is there, because I'm thinking just like you did, like how does reconciliation look like beyond the families, and what do we need to be doing? What should we be talking about? So have y'all had that kind of discussion?
Yeah, so many different things, but I'll share three really quick points for when we were in Virginia, we were in Hampton Roads, I think it was. We had a audience of 1,000 people came to this auditorium to hear us one night, and I think Plessy and Ferguson were with us. I got an email that night from a lady, and she said, you know, dear Miss Jackson, I was at your program tonight, and I'm an older white lady, and I have thought about these things before, but I never did anything about it. But I'm ashamed, and now I'm going to do something. I am motivated to go out and make a difference. So when it gets beyond the families, it's just the sharing of it and being able to meet. And I don't even know if we said hello and met her or shaked her hand or not. I don't really know. But she was there, and she was impacted. And the other thing is that Charlie started something in his community, which he admits was, you know, mostly all white, and most of his life was. But he called it Breaking Bread, and he asked a mutual friend to introduce him to a black couple, and they invited them to their home for dinner, and they began to share. And one of the funny stories he tells is that the man and the wife, he assumed that they were Democrats. As it turns out, I think, if I have this correct, I think he said that the wife was a Democrat, but the man was a Republican. So right away, their images were blown. And so they began to talk, and then they said, well, we're going to invite two more couples. And they kept doing this exponentially until they had a house full of people. And they began to share and talk and learn and live and love. And that's
And the reason I think that question is so important is because, you know, in the post-COVID world, we've seen the political climate really just plummet into to chaos, to hate, to you know, who you know the other is, and you know, it just seems like there's no way out, and I think people just get stuck. And so having discussions about reconciliation, about what people can actually do, not just talking about it or feeling bad or being shamed, but what do we actually do to transform the society? And so it takes me back to the old courthouse, because you know, we always have significant events down there, and we know why we're having it down there, because we're lifting up the not just the Dred Scott decision, but the role that the old courthouse played in slavery. And people were actually, you know, black folks was actually sold on the steps. And so it's forever going to be part of St. Louis history. But when I think about, for example, what's down there, who's going down there to see it, I'm talking about the Dred Scott mm-hmm. exhibit. Mm-hmm. Then there was the raising of monies for the Dred Scott statue.
That was us.
Yes. And so it's like, okay, if we think this is real history, why are we not taking it up as a society, as opposed to here's a family who thinks it's important, so they're doing all the heavy lifting. Right. And so not only did you all do the fundraising for the statue, you had to do some fundraising for headstones, and you know, and I'm just thinking, I mean, I know we all like gave to that, but it seems like there ought to be some kind of...
Let me share on that point. I think I hear where you're going. First, let me share that the old courthouse, despite some things that were said in the past, like this is St. Louis history, don't think this is about Dred Scott. That was many, 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 many years ago, even before I started the foundation. And I just blew that off. I said, whatever, I don't know what that person was thinking, but as we have come full circle, they understand the importance of it. And the people down there, the staff and the rangers and the administration, everyone, fabulous. So what they're doing now is they're converting the northeast wing facing the arch. It's now going to be the Dred and Harriet Scott Gallery and St. Louis History, Slavery History Gallery. So that is huge, because when I was growing up, their picture wasn't even on the wall. Mm. And when we gave them a picture to put there, our only family heirloom at one point, it was missing off the wall. The stipulation for my father was, as long as it's on the wall, you can use it. If it's off the wall, I want it back. And they had to find it. Mm. And so it's been in our possession. I have it right now ever since. And so the good news, though, is that they are giving them their own wing, their own gallery, mm. and it will now and forevermore be. So that I want to share that, because that is going to come in 2025, I believe.
Oh, okay, and I'm going to make an assumption that there's going to be a big hoopla about that.
Well, we've already had one. It's called Groundbreaking, A New Vision, is what they had in January of this. Oh, wait a minute. What year is this? What month is this? I don't know.
This is March of 2024.
Oh, God, I don't know. It was last year. But anyway, yeah, we had a beautiful little ceremony and so forth for that. Groundbreaking, A New Vision, because it wasn't really the ground we were breaking, but it was breaking that fallow ground of mm-hmm. our thinking. Mm-hmm. So they're on the ball. They really are on the ball.
So that's encouraging, because I think for most of us, we know that, and this is not just St. Louis, this is all over the country, that, you know, it's difficult for white people to recognize the ugly parts of that history and the role they played and the role that their ancestors played and the role that some of them are still playing, because even though you may not have been an enslaver, you're benefiting off the labor of black folks. And so that was so eloquent when, you know, the folks of the St. Louis University descendants of slaves, the enslaved, I mean, they were very vocal about that. You know, you all still got these buildings up that our families built. Yeah, so you owe big time. What has it been like to have
that kind of presence at a facility that is looked at, and people are going to be coming and going to be able to have that exhibit there in that way.
Well, I think it's certainly time for that. I mean, so many things we could be sharing. I tell you, an hour is never enough time. One thing is that the building itself should have been torn down. Now, I can't say that 100% it wasn't because of Dred Scott, but that did come up as another reason why not to tear down. But it belonged to the Chateau family, and as long as it was a courthouse, it was okay to stay. But when it no longer was and they moved down to the one on 12th Street, the Chateau family wanted that building, and they were going to raise it. But a judge declared that that wasn't going to happen. And that there's a funny little twist and turn in that little story. But that and the fact that Judge Scott's case was there, providentially, it was kept from being torn down. So,
and I don't think that's a tidbit that most people know about.
No, they don't.
Wow.
No, I've been researching since 1995, and I've got so many little jewels that I don't have time to ever hardly share. But, yeah, that is definitely a fact that could have. And, honestly, I think the judge just kind of like said, no, we're not going to do that, because I think the family had the right to get the building back. I mean, it sounds like they did.
Well,
here's a little funny twist. It's just like Drenton Hearing had the right to have Freeman, too. They didn't get it. Mm-hmm, sorry. Mm-hmm, to mm-hmm, get the building mm-hmm. back. It's kind of weird, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But at any rate, I'm happy that this is happening because it is a centerpiece of our city's history. And back when the Urban League had a convention here, probably it was 2007, because my dad died the next day, and we had a Dred Scott Day on the steps of the old courthouse on July the 25th, and my father passed on the 26th. But a gentleman who was here for the convention said, you know what, I've been coming to St. Louis with the Urban League for X number of years, he said, and this is the first time that I even knew that courthouse had anything to do with Dred Scott. He said to me, you all don't promote your city very well.
Mm.
And I thought, ooh, that stung.
And it's true.
It stung,
it's
but
true.
It was true. So to your question, I think this is a thing whose time has come, and I really feel that the Parks Service is rising to the occasion. I'm actually on the board of the National Parks Association, and we actually have so much going on. But one thing that I'm a part of is a group we started out by teaching teachers, and we called it Teaching Hard History, and now it's called Challenging History. And this has just mushroomed into some wonderful stuff. So you'll be seeing and hearing a lot more about how we're sharing, because you mentioned about people don't want to teach and hear about the hard history. And to me, it's really like, how do you teach it? You don't teach it to make people feel horrible and want to go kill themselves as teenagers in school. That's crazy. But the truth is out there. And then there's back, the rest of the story is things like the Tawney family. And I might mention the Blow family, who owned him.
Mm.
I have worked with them as much and maybe more than I have with the Tawneys. And they're amazing.
Hmm. Well, if you were just joining us, wow, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are live at Black Radio Hall of Fame, and my guest today, because it is the anniversary of the Dred Scott decision, Lynn Jackson, who is the founder of the foundation that is making sure the legacy of Dred Scott and his wife stay alive. And she's told us about many wonderful things that are going to be happening at the old courthouse. But, you know, you just got back from Utah, and you are invited to different things. I mean, part of it is really just bringing the story about Dred Scott and seeing what people do with that, how they hold that. But I'm just thinking about St. Louis. You know, I get a little bit disturbed sometimes that we, as somebody said to you, we don't promote our own history. And I remember one time going to the tourist website, and, you know, I'm looking at all the stuff that gets promoted, and I'm like, where's the black stuff? Because it's historic stuff right up there with the rest of this stuff. And so we just have to, and again, here's the thing about you have no rights that white people abound respect. So I'm always thinking about that in the background. It's like, we are citizens. Let's assert our citizenship until somebody tells us we ain't, because I guess they could use that the case law that is on the books. But we don't do enough as African Americans to make sure that our history is preserved, promoted, and respected. And I'd like to see the Heritage Foundation, the old courthouse might be on there, but you got the Griot, you got the Vachon Museum there. There are other sites that people can see and should see that are part of St. Louis history. So what was going on in Utah? Because I can't, I can think Mormon country every time I think Utah. So what was happening up there that they wanted to know about Dred Scott?
Well, they are Mormon country. And as many people are aware, they're also at the top of the heap when it comes to genealogical research. And they have an annual program called Roots Tech. And this was Roots Tech 2024, where people come from all over the country to the physical location, which is the Salt Palace. And then people tune in online to their segments and their sessions all over the world. And I was invited to come and be a keynote speaker, one of the main keynote speakers this year, and share the story of Dred Scott. Now, keynotes aren't always that long because there's a lot going on, but I had to pack it all in about 12 minutes, and it was beautiful. Quite an honor, because aside from the, I don't know, maybe 15 people that come physically there and the whole crowd, there's also last year between 3 and 4 million people who watched online.
Wow.
So the audience is global and it's huge. And they also are getting very much into how AI helps people find their, when you hit that brick wall and you just can't get any further, they've been very helpful. So we were there for that. And it was an amazing opportunity. I met with many people. I had lunches, I had dinners, I had media everywhere. It was amazing. But it was incredible just to be able to have that large of an audience to hear even just that thumbnail about Dred Scott and what we're doing to keep his legacy alive.
And I'm thinking about having that kind of a global audience. How does that translate to support for the foundation? Do you all get bumps in financial contributions after you do your speaking like that?
It just happened a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that some people will, eventually do that, because it will be online. I'm sure it'll stay up there for a while. We probably have it on our website in a few days. And it'd be nice if that would happen.
Because talk about how the foundation gets sustained. It's based on, grants and donations.
That's right.
And I know that, somehow or another I made a donation and I got like this big copper penny with, I
created that.
Oh, okay, because I look at it every day. I have it up there with my awards
and
stuff.
You did that a long time ago.
Yeah.
Because we stopped giving those out that way. And then, okay, so let's back up.
I mean, it's a huge penny,
Right. Look, that's a nice penny.
I'm
going to tell you how nice it is. We use that for the Dred Scott Freedom Awards plaque now. And unfortunately, Abraham Lincoln, which is on the back, mm-hmm. you can't see, but the image I created of the penny of Dred on his side is what's on the plaque for the
award. I have that on that side. Yes. I don't have it on the Lincoln side. Mine is always going to be on the Dred Scott side.
Thank you. That's always good. I really wanted to put it in plexiglass so that you could see both. It's very expensive, and you can't find too many people that do it well. But yeah, that's amazing. Well, that was one of the first things I created, because what could you find of Dred Scott's back in the day? A postcard. So if you go to dredscottlives.org, we do have retail items out there that you can buy, including the family book, my coloring book, and now we have a tie of Dred Scott. But we have several things. And so, that was the original thing that I created, and I loved it.
I cherish that. I really do.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the products and the merchandise that you have that people can buy, because sometimes people say, I really would like something for my donation. Well, there's a lot of stuff that's there. But it's also this whole notion of honoring that. And I don't know, for example, where the Blows lived with
with Dred and Harriet, is that someplace that's also noted in y'all's history, like where he actually lived?
Originally, their plantation in Southampton, Virginia, is the land is still there. I did get to go and see it when they put a highway marker in for him around 2010 or 11 and 12, somewhere in there. And the land is there. The house is no longer there. So that is a place. And there is a highway marker nearby. So that's a good thing.
But what about when they came here?
Well, when they came here, they tried to open a bed and breakfast. And, you know, we cleared out the riverfront. So hardly anything exists that would. Now, the Roswell Field House is still there. The Field House Museum mm-hmm. is one of the only row houses that's still standing because of Eugene Field, the child poet, and his father, Roswell. And they have converted it so that you really understand that Roswell and Dred were very important. The child poet and all of his toys and books are still there. But the importance of that house has become Roswell Field's role in taking Dred Scott's case to the Supreme Court of the United States. So most of those places are no longer there. But in our book, we do have a map that shows where Dred and Harriet did live in downtown area. And when we first did that, I was so shocked to find out that they only lived a few blocks from where I had parked my car for 10 years. Where I worked for the Girl Scout Council. I know. And so...
Is there a marker there?
Not yet, no.
Okay.
Now, you know, there's some kind of programs trying to get off the ground here, markers and things. And I'm trying to see what they're going to be able to do and where that might lead. But... it's not as easy as you think.
No, because the folks that are doing the lynching, they're trying to put markers where there were lynchings, and you know, folks are like, we ain't having that. You know, we don't need to remember that. But you know, that's a whole struggle that we need to do because that's part of the ugly but real history of this country. But you know, based on all the violence and the hate and racism that's going on, you know, just recently. The statue of Jackie Robinson was torn down and burned up, and then there was also this thing of a statue of Martin Luther King. Is there any fear on you all's part that the statue that stands in front of the old courthouse will be vandalized?
I don't fear, and I pray that it won't, but no, I'm not afraid of it. You know, we don't know. Listen, I've done programs on statues being torn down and taken up. I've done several programs about that. And when you deface Jesus Christ and Mary, you know, there's nothing sacred. And you don't know. But I'm believing that we'll be fine. I don't bring that up. We're going to let that go.
But yeah, but I'm keeping my eye open. I'm keeping my eye open.
Yeah, well, I'll keep my
because
eye
like
open.
I said, you, like you said, nothing is sacred. You know, they tore down a statue of Jackie Robinson. And so what else can they do? And then Martin Luther King. But, yeah, I just think that, you know, the volume is being turned up on the hate, and anything that's black seems to be a target, especially our history and our very, you know, essence. And so I just, you know, have to be on watch for that. We had talked for a minute before you came on that you also found out that you were related to Oscar Charleston.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's two famous people in your family. Talk about who's Oscar Charleston?
Oscar Charleston. He is a mega superstar in the Negro Baseball League. And a lot of people won't necessarily know his name, but those in the game do. And when they hear it, they just laugh. And it's amazing to me. He's on my mother's side. He's my great-great uncle, and my great-grandfather is his brother. When I first saw his picture, I said, oh, my God, they look like twins. But I did my own research on him for several years, too, to be sure. And then I called a cousin who I knew would know because she's like a great-niece. And she said, yeah, girl, did you know that? I said, nobody said anything. My mother did mention she had a famous baseball player. But Oscar Charleston had a lifetime average of 364. He was in the Cooperstown Hall of Fame in the early 70s. And he just last year was invested into the Pittsburgh Hall of Fame because the Pittsburgh Croppers was one of the teams that he took to championship twice. He was a manager as well. He helped Branch Rickey recruit and may have indirectly helped recruit Jackie Robinson. He was fearless. There's a story about him where he got in a fight with Ku Klux Klan, took their hoods off. And Jeremy Beer wrote the story of him. It's a 500-page book that outlines his life. He's a five-tool player, for those of you who know baseball. And they say that, I never can say this man's name when I need to. One of the superstar white players is an Oscar Charleston wannabe. And I can't think of his name.
It's right probably now. Best.
I don't know. But anyway, he's amazing. He is. So I've done a program on him a couple of times. I have a whole, it's in the can. It's ready to go if anybody wants to hear about him. But I'm very excited to know. So in the meantime, if you go to DredScottLives.org, the Major League Baseball honored him and Turkey Stearns and Josh Gibson, and I'm sorry I don't know the fourth person's name right now, but they honored all four of them on their Instagram site. So it's MLB Instagram. You can Google it, put in any of their names, and you will hear relatives like myself and Sean Gibson. We narrate about a one-minute tribute to them, and it's on their site for the whole world to see, and tells you a little bit about how amazing they were.
And that whole Negro baseball legacy and history has not reached the magnitude that it should. And it seems like maybe in the last 3 or 4 years there have been people pushing to make sure that that history is preserved. In Kansas City they have the Negro Baseball Museum, and so in different places people recognize it. Of course, that was based on Satchel Paige being there in Kansas City, and you know, we have Cool Papa Bell here, and Norman Say made sure that at least there was a street named after him, but it could be so much more. I mean, all around us, Lynn, is just history of our people, but we don't know it. We're looking right at it and don't know what it is.
You know who I try to promote when I get a minute to squeeze her in is Julia Davis.
Julia Davis.
Because, I mean, she, I guess she's a contemporary of mine because she died like 40 years ago at 100. But I knew her. I knew her well. I heard her. I was at her funeral. And people need to know people like her.
Yeah, Julia Davis and people, you know.
You know what? For those listening, she was one of the only people I know who had a library named after her while she was still living. Built
That's right.
and named for her. And
That's
not
right.
only one, but two. And she would not die until the second one on Newstead Natural Bridge was finished.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful facility, and people should go and check it out.
Yeah.
I am proud to be a lifetime member of the Friends of Julia Davis Library. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's how much I revere her.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you talk about reading and literacy for black kids back then, and the fact that she had a library that she let people come in and read, and she was reading to folks. You know, again, this is all around us, and certain people have made it possible for us to go and see and feel and touch, and we just need to take advantage of it.
Well, you hit on something that I'm glad you said, because I want to share this. One of the programs I created for Dred Scott Heritage Foundation is called Reading, a Civil Right. And we did this about 5 or 6 years ago. And it had two components at the time, and now it has three. One component was love for literacy. The other one was teaching people to read, which we could use some tutors. Hello, recruiting out there. But I think if you live in America and you can't read, that's a crime. There's no reason for it. It's not hard, and everybody deserves that. I think it's a right. But the third thing we just added about a year ago was a science fiction reading club. And I'd love for young men to be big in that, but it's not just for boys. It's for girls. But science fiction did so much for my husband when he was growing up. He's brilliant. He has a great vocabulary. And he's just, I mean, but science fiction opens the vistas of possibilities up. So we've started this. And the first group of men, young men, who were in our science fiction reading club were young boys in a maximum detention center in Green Hill up in Seattle. And so we would love to keep these programs going and really get them a little bit more up and running. So that's just near and dear to my heart, what you were saying about reading.
Yeah. We've had a couple of people on. One of them talked about the banned books, and the other one talked about the Reading is a Right campaign that the NAACP has launched.
Oh, I just saw that. Yes, mm-hmm. And we were doing ours like 5 or 6 years ago, and I would love to find out more about what they're trying to do. But that's what we're doing.
Because I'm like you, Lynn. It ought to be a crime not to be reading by the age of 7.
at least
a crime. And I know there's many reasons why, and one of the things that the Reading is a Right campaign has found out, that this last generation of children, maybe it's been a couple of generations, were not taught the phonics part. They were taught the whole, and people don't know how important that is. I mean,
the whole program.
Yes, yes, we almost did. I mean,
yes, no,
so I think that piece of it, when you look at somebody that's 21 or older, and you say, "Why can't you read? You're just trifling. You just
no."
It was the way that they were taught.
Right. If you go to the Sight Say method, God help us all. I won't go into it today, but Sight Say method, people, it's an abomination.
Yeah. I mean, if we don't, the phonics part was how we learned, and sometimes people think something new is better. It's not always better. And then we had, like I said, a whole generation of folks that can't read because we thought whole language and, you know, something fancy as opposed to sounding out words would be a more superior way of teaching kids to read. And, you know, so you could have a book and you could say, oh, this is a book should animate kids and have them interested in reading. But if they don't have the technique, it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. It's totally frustrating.
You can't just go with pictures every time you pick up a book. Well, that's my sore spot, so
yeah. Well, it's a place that we need to continue to look at. If folks are going to enjoy some of the things that we've talked about today, going to the new exhibition of the Scott legacy in 2025, there are things to read. So people have to read.
Yeah.
And so even when you go to the Science Center, there's things to read as to how things work. So I just can't even imagine not being able to read, and going through a world where you got text and you have all of that going on. It's gotta be a frustrating thing. Lynn Jackson, I am so honored to be here. And like you said, we could go a whole another hour around. That time is up. Yes, it is.
No, we have 8 more things on our list.
Yeah, we got 15 more things on the list that we didn't get to. Oh. But we'll have to bring you back again because it seems like there's always something going on with the foundation and you're traveling and taking the story and the gift that Harriet and Scott left us a gift that keeps on giving. So I think we should make sure that we do that and we become the stewards of that history as your family has done.
Can I ask people to go to dredscottlives.org and download or sign our petition for a Dred Scott stamp? I respect your time, but please do that.
Yes, definitely. And while you're there, if you can't go anywhere, do any of the, give some money. That's always something you could do. Give some money. That's always something that will help the foundation to continue to move. Next week, you know, this is today in Jeff City. Some folks are there. It's been busy. There's a lot of lobby days going on, and I was getting calls about what, you know, hearings and stuff. So next week we're going to have a couple of people who are, you know, lobbyists and legislative aides with different organizations who are going to come and give us an update on legislation that we should be following, and that if passed is going to be harmful to us. And so we want to make sure we stay on top of that. And so we got a couple of great folks that will be talking about that. This is Jamala Rogers, your host with Voices from the Battlefield, and we just got a hour full of nuggets about Harriet and Scott, Harriet and Dred Scott, and you all should go to the monument, you should go to the headstones, and it's a lot there that we can go see, so